Hi, friends. Greg Kokel here. So glad you've joined me and looking forward to chatting with you. If you'd like to call in, the number, for the record, 855-243-9975. That's 855-243-9975. It's outside of the U.S. You can call this number, 562-424-8229, and different times we get international calls. We've gotten a few calls recently from down under, and they're like in the middle of the night, it seems, but glad to have them, and glad to have your calls, too. I want to mention again, just a reminder, because the clock is ticking for the, shall we say, the early bird registration for Southern California Rethink. That's coming up here February. That's coming up September 24th and 25th. So we're about 9 weeks out. And as right now, we have almost 700 people that have signed up in advance. And following the patterns of the past, that's a lot more than we had in the past at this time for Orange County. Okay. But following the patterns of the past, knowing how many people sign up the last few days because they want to gain that advantage of saving some money with the early bird discount, plus they want to get their name in to make sure that they can get in the main auditorium, which only holds 2,000. If we follow the same pattern as we did in the past, by August 1st, when the early bird discount ends, we'll have almost 2,000 people, which is the capacity for the main auditorium at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa. And now we have more room. We're going to squeeze people in a couple different places. There's a big gym they're going to use, but there's going to be a projection then, a screen. And there's some other places we'll squeeze you in. We can take another 1,000. So 3,000 is the absolute limit. Listen, 2 years ago, before COVID, 2019, we had 2,700. All right. So, and right now I'm looking at we are moving so much faster with signups that it could very likely be that we're just going to have to say sometime in the next few weeks, we're full up to the gills. We cannot take another individual. All right. The fire department won't let us do that. That means we'll be right at 3,000, which, of course, we'd be thrilled, but we want you to be included, okay? So if you go to realityapologetics.com and all the breakdown of all of the realities this year are there, including the new one in Philly in March. So let me give you them in order, okay? We've got Orange County coming up, 9/24, September 24th and 25th. We have the Seattle area. It's I want to say Billingham. It's kind of like not Seattle proper, but it's just right next to it. But I always get these names mixed up. But it's right there. You'll see it on the online. Okay, that's October 15th and 16th. We'll be in Minneapolis, St. Paul, November 12th and 13th. And let's see, September 20th. let me just pause for a minute. When I meant to say September a few moments ago, I said February. Now I'm trying to say February, and I'm saying September. What's going on here? All right. Dallas, 2022, February 25th and 26th. And then Philadelphia, that's the first time we're in the Northeast and thrilled to open up our sixth event, March 25th and 26th. And then finally, in Augusta, Georgia, April 22nd and 23rd. Bellevue. Thank you. Bellevue. I got to think of that. It's like a viewing the bell. Be able to have a view of the bell. Bellevue. Isn't Bellevue like an insane asylum or something somewhere? Yeah, this is why maybe I balk at that, you know. But these aren't crazy people. We're going to be in Bellevue talking about crazy ideas. And in fact, from chaos to clarity is the theme of this event. So we're looking forward to having you there. All the speakers are at the lineup for our events is at realityapologetics.com. So we're covered. Just go there and you'll get all the skinny. All right. I want to talk to you just a little bit about something I suspect I've talked to you about before, but I want to put a little different. Gee, I don't like the word spin. No, I mean, that's the word that came to mind, because spin implies distortion, and I'm not, I have no interest in distorting anything. I want you to see something from a new angle. Okay. And it happens to be, I have to do with what I am writing about, in the solid ground that is like 3 weeks overdue, but coming out September 1st. Is that right? Yeah, because August 1st is coming up next week. So, yeah, I'm getting like behind the eight ball on this one. But I'm working hard because I'm following a theme from the beginning of the year. And I'm trying to make a point. I'm trying to give you, my readers, a picture, a big picture, as it were, of a flow of something. And by the way, if you don't get solid ground, all right, please sign up for it. If you have our app, it shows up on our app, the STR app. It's free. You can get it wherever you buy apps, the app store, right? I don't know if you can get the app at str.org, but you get the app at the app store, right? Okay. What do I know? You know, I'm an old guy. But that's where people get apps, at the store, the app store. You know how to do that. But if you are not receiving our solid ground or our mentoring letter, and these are bi-monthly switcheroos, every other month we switch, so that you get six solid ground, six mentoring letters every year from us, I want to send them to you. I work hard on these things. Sometimes I companion with other speakers or other or standaries and staff, and we work on it together. I've done things with Alan and Tim and Brett in the past, and but the point is, it's our way of keeping you up to speed, educated, informed, trained on a regular basis. Bang, bang, bang. Me mentoring you, our team mentoring you in the things you need to know to be more effective as ambassadors in our rapidly changing and challenging culture. Our rapidly changing and increasingly challenging culture. And this is one way we do that. But we can't send it to you if we don't know where to send it. You go to SDR.org. Let's see. I think in the upper right-hand corner of the webpage, the homepage there, it says subscribe. That's all you got to do. Punch the button and if you follow the prompts. And we will send stuff to you. But if you haven't read the first few issues of this year, I want you to go do that. Because I have been sounding a kind of warning about a trend I've been tracking, which is an ideologically driven downward trajectory of secular culture that is rapidly eroding our fundamental freedoms in a way that American Christians have never encountered before. Now, those of you who've been listening to me, you know I'm not a Chicken Little guy, okay? But I am concerned, really concerned, about what I'm seeing. And in January, I kind of gave you a glimpse of what tyranny looks like because I told you about my experiences with Christians who were trapped behind the Iron Curtain under Soviet dominion and what it looked like for them. I was working there with them 5.5 weeks I spent behind the Iron Curtain. I was like in 5 or 6 communist countries, including the former Soviet Union. All right. So I talked about there to kind of give you a taste to launch this theme that I'm focusing in on this year. And then 2 months later in March, I talked about a concept that that human lives are going to be ruled by one of two fundamental forces. That is either truth or power. And way back in the beginning, with our first parents, there is what I call the primal heresy. And that is when our Adam and Eve exchanged the external rule of God and the objective truth of his world out there for the internal rule of their own desires. That's inside. That's the inside-outside exchange that's at the heart of all forms of relativism. And when they did, they just plunged humanity into a struggle between the truth that brings liberty on the one hand and powerful forces that are intent on extinguishing both truth and liberty, which is precisely what we're facing now. What we're facing now, the core of it goes all the way back to the beginning. That's what I'm saying. All the way back to the beginning. It's the same thing that's playing itself out. This struggle against God for our own autonomy. We want to be masters of our fate, captains of our own ship. We don't want God telling us what to do. The problem is that even though we are looking for freedom from all of that, we aren't free. We're slaves. We're slaves to our own broken nature. We're slaves to the one that our first parents obeyed rather than God. And that is the devil. I talk about this in the story of reality if you want to brush up on it. And but in any event, that's what I talked about in March and the primal heresy. But then in May, I talked about how that particular struggle has manifested itself in current cultural skirmishes that reveal this trend towards totalitarianism in America. Okay, and I talked about there being a unusual species of oppression, which is an amalgam between hard totalitarianism, which would come from the government top down, but also a soft totalitarianism, which comes from our community and the community, the cultural institutions, as it were, like the academy or like the media or Hollywood or those who control the moguls who control social media. These are all players that are seeking to get a hold of Americans and compel them in a certain ideological direction. And then finally in July, which is the one that just came out, the solid ground that just came out, I alerted you to a specific instance in this truth power struggle by comparing two ways that the injustice of racism has been addressed in our country. And that is the truth-centered, on my view, on my understanding, is my assessment, the truth-centered civil rights movement of the 60s, which was led by the Reverend Martin Luther King, and by contrast, the more so-called progressive, power-centered approach known as critical race theory, or CRT. And that was the last one, and I'm sounding a warning about that. That was the last solid ground. And what I am doing this time is trying to give you some insight about how that first fall of humanity orchestrated by the devil reflects a struggle that is still in place. But the struggle on a human level is, I just want to be free. I want to be me. I want you do you, you know, that kind of thing. But all that is a symptom of something else going on behind the scenes. And this takes us right to Ephesians 6. And so my intent in this piece that I'm struggling to write well for your sakes is to try to show the connection between the particulars that we see in our culture right now and a grander, larger, when I say grander, not better, but bigger strategy in the spiritual realm of the devil to continue his efforts to undermine God's purposes for human flourishing in this world. All right? And what this then brings me to is Ephesians 6 and the concept of spiritual warfare. Now, I've said a number of times, it bears repeating, that I think that spiritual warfare is misunderstood by a lot of Christians, because I think many Christians understand spiritual warfare to be a kind of power encounter with the devil. And what that looks like is a kind of a way of addressing demonic powers using our authority as Christians and using prayer that is meant to push against the devil and his designs. Now, I'm not against that. I mean, I think there certainly is an element of that. I'm not really comfortable with the binding and loosing things because, you know, when Jesus told us to pray, he didn't tell us to pray at the devil. Rather, he said, ask the Father, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil. I think that's the literal rendering of it. It usually says the evil one. But when I pray this, I say from the evil circumstances, the evil one, deliver us, me, my family, from all of that. Okay? So the prayers are to be not, you know, it seems to be not directed at the devil, but I pray this other way because that's what Jesus said to do. So, but in any event, regardless, the bulk of spiritual warfare, the substance of it, the content of it, is not in power encounters where prayer is involved. Now, it does say it towards the end of chapter 6, where it talks about our spiritual weaponry. Verse 18, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit, and with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints. So in the context of the spiritual battle and the spiritual armor, there's a reference to prayer. No question. However, I don't think that's what the substance of spiritual battle is all about. It isn't the heart and core of it. Something else is going on. And when I look at what the Scripture says about the devil and his impact on humanity, I learn a couple of different things, all right, that are relevant to the broader issue that we're talking about of spiritual warfare. I read, for example, in Revelations chapter 12, verse 9, that the devil has deceived the whole world, okay? I read in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, that he has blinded the eyes of the unbelieving. I read in 2 Timothy chapter 2, and I'm just looking for the exact words because this is one that I don't remember off the top of my head. But 2 Timothy chapter 2, right at the end, Paul talks about us being gentle and patient when we are wronged by others in order that God might grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth and that they come to their senses and escape, listen to the language, from the snare of the devil having been held captive by him to do his will. And finally, to kind of cap it all off, 1 John 5:19, John writes, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. So what this teaches us is that the way that the devil controls the world is by blinding them, capturing them, deceiving them, lying to them, and controlling them in that way. And indeed, this is consistent with what Jesus told us about the devil. He's a liar. He speaks from his own nature. And this is why I think, to put it most directly, I think that the bulk, the vast majority of spiritual warfare is not a power encounter, but a truth encounter. Remember, Jesus said it is the truth that sets free, and specifically in that context, it's the truth that he teaches. If you abide in my word, and my word abides in you, then you're truly disciples of mine, and the truth will set you free. That truth sets you free, and he goes on to talk about freedom from sin. But we're not free from sin because we are slaves to sin before as unregenerate people and slave to the devil who uses that slavery to encourage us to sin more. Because prior to regeneration. The devil's our father. This seems to be a straightforward application of things that Jesus says to the Jews in John chapter 8. And so this concept of spiritual warfare being a truth encounter is reinforced by something Paul says directly about spiritual battle in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3, 4, 5, 6, right in there somewhere. He says the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. Okay, they're not like human-powered. Flesh could mean the fallen self. They could also mean just basic humanity. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven, Jesus said. So it means you didn't figure this out on your own. God is the one who is operating so you'd have that knowledge. So I think that's what he means here. He says the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. They are not human-powered, but they are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. All right, hey, wow, I want some of that stuff, that divinely powerful weaponry. Well, then he tells in the very next verse exactly what it is. He says, we are casting down speculations. It's a speculation. That's a kind of like a theory, right? We are casting down speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. There's the truth part. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And I don't think he means in that passage that we're thinking pure thoughts. You know, we're not thinking nasties. We shouldn't be doing that. But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about thinking accurate, true thoughts. In other words, we tear down the falsehoods and we replace them, even in our own mind, with truth. Okay? And that's why the first, and I might have mentioned this already, the first piece of our spiritual weaponry there in Ephesians 6 is the belt of, truth. The belt of truth. Okay? Our first piece of spiritual armor. So now with all that in place, what I'm saying here is that spiritual battle entails a truth encounter, principally. So therefore, stand to reason, we're in the spiritual battle business, because what we're trying to do is tear down those speculations and lofty things raised up against the knowledge of God and take our thoughts and your thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ, captive to the truth. Now, when I look, by the way, and I just noticed this today, I mean, it stuck out to me in a way it hadn't before, in this section on spiritual battle, Ephesians 6, starting in verse 10. What Paul writes is, finally, he's been giving some instruction about appropriate moral behavior. Family relationships, most recently there in the beginning of chapter 6. But then in verse 10, he starts out, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And then he talks about our struggle is not against flesh and blood. And you know that passage probably. But I'm just underscoring here something. It's underlined in my Bible, but for some reason it struck me. Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. In other words, I'm going to talk to you about battle. You're in a fight. You need to have the right armor on, but you need to step up and face the hardship of the fight. Be strong. That's where he starts. Be tough. Now, you don't have to be tough on your own. Remember, the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh. Okay, they're not of us. Be strong what? In the Lord. Be tough in the Lord. Be strong and tough in the strength of his might. But he's just starting out with an exhortation that is a warning that the battle is going to be tough. And then he explains the nature of that battle. It's a battle that is not against the people in front of us. Battle is not against flesh and blood. It's not against those folk. Not really. There is something going on in the heavenly places. There is a scheme that we are to stand firm against. What's a scheme? It's kind of like a program, like a strategy. And yes, the devil has strategies. The devil has a scheme. He's got a program. He's enacting a plan that is meant to undermine God's purposes. That's what I want you to get. That in this spiritual battle where lies prevail that capture and captivate humans, these are part of a larger scheme aimed at a different purpose. It's aimed at undermining God and undermining God's good plan for human flourishing. Be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. Do it. Engage in fruitful activity. Do meaningful things. Flourish. And God has a particular purpose for doing, when I say a particular plan for doing, God has his plan. Satan has his plans. He's got his schemes. Okay. So what I want to show you in this piece I'm writing, so you're getting an inside look at the struggles of a writer to say something meaningful in print, and I'm kind of thinking out loud here about these ideas. What I want you to see is that all the nasties that are going on today are all part of a larger scheme to undermine God and God's good plan for humanity. But the thing is, when the scheme is kind of in play, it's not the kind of thing that's going to, be shouted from the rooftops. Okay? It's sometimes it's just going to be quietly whispered, so it has this subtle influence on you. It's a tickling of the ears. It's not a megaphone. I mean, it can't get to be a megaphone. I'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to try to characterize just for a moment this larger story, this larger scheme that starts with mankind's rebellion, but that didn't happen in a vacuum. Man's rebellion in quest for autonomy, that is their self-rule, freedom from God's rules, from God's ways, that didn't happen in a vacuum, because in the beginning, there was an instigator of the rebellion, and he's the one orchestrating the larger moves of the schemes, the sinister scheme to subvert God's good world. And in the beginning, he assaults the core, the foundation, replacing God's, and I already mentioned this, external objective truth with man's internal subjective, scare quotes here, truth. That's relativism. Relativism was birthed in the beginning, at the fall, in the very beginning of our story, chapter 3. That's the problem. And it's continued ever since. Man's fight against God to rule himself instead of being ruled by God. But of course, like I mentioned, he's not ruling himself. His fallen nature is ruling him. The devil's ruling him. He's captured by the devil to do his will. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. That's the reality. But after the the first attack, that is essentially the relativistic move to get people convinced that they're the most important. It's all about me. You do you. Okay? Then the second strike kind of lays siege to God's good purpose for man to be fruitful and multiply. And that's right there, right in the first chapter. And what do we see now? We see that holy union of one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. And you can go to Matthew 12 for that. That's Jesus. It's a summary of Jesus' description of God's purpose from the beginning. Well, that's now being replaced by a twisted anything goes sex, anything goes gender, and anything goes marriage. Right? That's the substitute. That's the dark, twisted substitute. So all of this that you see going on now, that is just a subversion of God's purposes. Do people involved in this know about that? No, they don't know about it. Why? Because the snake is in the shadows. He's not dancing around for everybody to see. His minions doing his bidding don't realize the stranglehold that he has on them. But what they end up doing is offer darkness as light. And how do they do that? Well, they clothe vice with a vocabulary of virtue, with words like tolerance, diversity, equity, inclusion, broad-mindedness, dialogue, justice, but above all, love. All of these sweet, good, virtuous words they are using to describe their unvirtuous ideas, impulses, and behaviors. So it makes it sound so good. And what do they do to the virtuous things? Well, they use the vocabulary of evil to subvert those things. Words like intolerance and bigotry and inequity and injustice, but above all, hate. And in the process of the enemy orchestrating this, using his minions who are unsuspecting and unwitting to the purposes he has in mind for them. We're not. We understand because we know the truth. We see the. We read about reality in this book. We see how the language is being used to manipulate people, to fool people. And what happens is the first thing to go is the gateways of information, and that's the academy and Hollywood and the media. Okay? Boom, boom, boom. Because they're the ones who are using the words to twist things and to turn people's thinking. And then what happens next? Education is next. And then big business falls. And finally, the big stick, the law. But they don't fall fast and hard. They crumble slowly. And most people hardly notice because they are duped by the language. So I mentioned that some of the lies are quiet ones, not shouted from the rooftops, but whispered. But as the power balance shifts, and this is what I see happening, and when you, I think you can see it too, because you are not fooled by the enemy. When the power balance shifts, the lies get bolder and they get more aggressive, and coercion begins to replace persuasion, because dissent gets silenced and dissidents get punished and the noose tightens and totalitarianism waits at the door. That's what's going on right now in what people thought was irrevocably the land of the free. Anyway, let me just give you an example of maybe a whisper, okay? And you might not even agree with this. You might think, oh, you're just seeing things. You're just kind of like oversensitive. You're getting a little bit Chicken Little-ish here on me. Well, okay, you can make the judgment yourself. But my sense is that my senses are sensitized with exposure to the truth and understanding how thinking works and how abuse of thinking works. I've been trafficking in this a long time. And as guys will sometimes say, I know when to put my boots on, all right? And now's the time because I see things happening in culture that are really, really abusive, like silencing dissent. You know, when somebody's trying to silence dissent one way or another, through calling names or shouting over you or canceling you or firing you, which is all happening now for dissidents of the politically correct narrative, when they do that, I know that they do not have a good case. Because if they had a good case, they would place that case out there and defeat the wrong ideas. They have no good case. That's why they have to use oppression. The people who are so sensitive to oppression and an illicit use of force and bullying are the biggest bullies on the block and oppress with an illicit use of force now that they have it. And they do. They have it in the government. They have it in the media. They have it in Hollywood. They have it in the academy. And they have it in the moguls of social media. And they have it in big business. It's all gone woke. They have the power. All this speaking truth to power, that's nonsense. They are the power, and they don't care about the truth. They don't even believe in truth, not in the sense that we talk about it as facts. It's only their truth that matters. But I'll give you an illustration, though, of an example of what I think is a kind of a whisper. Now, I fly Delta a lot. I like Delta. It's a great airline. It's not the biggest. American is the biggest. But Delta, I think, is a better airline to fly. And a lot of people think that, too. I love it. I'm a platinum flyer for many years. I'll never be diamond, though I have the miles. I just haven't spent enough money with them, so they don't push me up there. Probably half of my flights, I fly first class, so they bump me up. And I always fly in Comfort Plus. I'm never back in steerage with my knees under my chin, not on Delta. So I'm good. I'm good with Delta, right? But I just want to, I've made some observations, and I'm just going to, my experience, all right? And I flew into LAX yesterday on Delta, all right? And as I walk down the jetway to board my Delta flight, I'm greeted by picture posters that line the walls along this hallway, and these posters depict different typical passengers. Okay, so let me tell you what the posters amount to. I know them all because I've walked by them so many times. They include a shot of two gay guys cuddling in their seats. I mean, it's not just like two guys sitting together. These two guys are cuddling, all right? Has a shot of two 20-something gals. They're not cuddling, but they're enjoying kind of a travel fling. You have an unmarried couple on a junket of some sort. Now, I know they're unmarried because there's no wedding rings. I can see it, all right? You got a young woman holding a child. I don't know if this is to represent a single mom. You have a female Hispanic in combat fatigues. So there's your person of color fighting in the military. You have a black gal in a construction suit and wearing a hard hat. You have a smiling flight attendant. And then you have a couple of others of individual travelers who are, you know, embarking on business or adventures. Okay. What's missing? There's not a single picture of a family. Not one. No mom, dad, and kids. It's not there. Now, there are a lot of moms and dads on flights. Lots of kids, too, especially the flight from Detroit to LAX yesterday. But no pictures of them. So once I'm on board, I check my personal entertainment monitor, you know, sitting right here in front of me. And when it comes on, it asks you to punch in your language. I hit English, and the very next thing that comes up on the display is what's called Delta's Spotlight feature. It's what they want you to watch. We're just putting this front and center. What is it? It's Netflix's Queer Eye. And then when I surveyed the 36 selections in Delta's, what they call the new onboard category. That means these are films that if you've been flying for a while, these are the new ones. You've seen the other ones, so here's the newest ones. There's 36 of them. 36 selections, 20% focus on gay themes. 20%. Notice no loud voices here. No shouting it from the rooftops. Just smooth, subtle, quiet, socializing to a secular view of reality, a quiet lie. You know what happens when you see a bunch of that? Not just there. That's just one example. If I thought about it for a while, I could give you dozens because I see it everywhere. You start absorbing that stuff and you start getting influenced by that, which is precisely the point. It is to re-educate and re-socialize people to a different view of reality, a view that makes good looks look bad and bad look good. These are bad looking good. Not every poster was bad. That wasn't the point, really. But the multitude of posters and nothing about a family, that communicates a subtle message. And then the pro-gay element that's all in here. Why does Delta have to champion that? It's obviously championing it. Why? Well, because it's just where culture's going. And we're actually, to put it more precisely, where culture is being driven. And what is driving culture in that direction? Rulers, powers, world forces of darkness, spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's what's driving it. And I'll give you in the article, I'm going to give more examples. This was just one of the quiet ones. But there are a lot more aggressive ones because, as I mentioned, when the power base shifts and those that are, in a certain sense, minions of darkness are in control, then they can be much more bold. They can be much more aggressive. Let me just draw a parallel. And people don't like this kind of parallel because they think, the Third Reich was unique. Well, in some ways, I guess it was, but as a totalitarian movement, it wasn't. This is how these things work. Hitler did not want to take over everything by force. He wanted to do it by votes. And there would be, in the Reichstag, there was vote after vote after vote after vote. They kept running it again, trying to get new numbers. Because he never had a majority until after the Reichstag fire, which they started and blamed on the communists and then ran all the communists out, then they got a majority. But the point, he did not want it to appear like he was just a ruthless dictator. It became obvious that he was, clearly. But he wanted the people to vote him in. See, you see, this is what a totalitarian approach does. When you have a mere dictator, you have a jackboot on the neck of the people. Here, you do what I say or else. That's it. It's just very simple, off with his head kind of deal. But a totalitarian regime is different. It means to get the people to think in a different way, a totally different way. They are influenced to adopt the view of the dictator, and so they come along largely willingly, which is exactly what happened in the Third Reich. And it's exactly what's happening here. We don't have a Hitler. We don't need one. The relevant groups are walking in lockstep. The ones who maintain or control the gates of communication, they all believe the same thing. It's not a conspiracy. They don't have to all meet together in a secret room. I was going to say smoke-filled room, but they don't smoke. They're against that. They blow bubbles. No, they don't have to do that because they all think the same. And there are other forces that are promoting either subtly or aggressively, these ideas. And now I was talking about CRT, and I wrote about it just this last Solid Ground. That's one of the more aggressive, heavy-handed examples of that. And I could, read you quotes, but I'm going to save them, of what's going on in the schools. But I'm going to save them for the article, which you can get September 1. Be informed, though. Be aware. There is a larger scheme being played out. And all the people, all the individuals, they're pawns. And they don't see it. They don't get it. They think they're noble. They think they're taking the high moral ground because even while they deny morality in any objective sense, they still think they're taking the high moral ground. I mean, this is kind of a contradiction, right? How can that be? Well, because they're human beings made in the image of God. They can't get away from the moral project. Nevertheless, this puts Christians right in the crosshairs. Christians are right in the crosshairs because of what they believe. And keep in mind, what the enemy is trying to destroy is God's purposes, and the representatives of God's purposes are Christians. So culturally, the enemy can go after all these areas, as I've described, but ultimately, it's got to go right to the heart, to Christians. Now, I don't know how successful he's going to be in this country at this time, so I'm not making any prophecies, but it doesn't look good. And a lot of people who are careful watchers in the culture are sounding the warning. And by the way, you don't even have to be regenerate to see it. People on the right, people in the middle, and even left, on the left, especially classical liberals, are starting to see the problems. Barry Weiss, the New York Times, B-A-R-I, she's a woman, but she's a lesbian, and she's left of center. And she's one that's leading the charge in her articles about the abuse of those who take exception with the system, especially CRT. And she just recently did a piece featuring Abigail Schreier, who wrote Irreversible Damage, drawing attention to the terrible things that are happening to girls who are trying to be boys and how the culture is abetting it and cutting their bodies up. Irrevocably, you don't change that. You have both breasts removed. You don't put them back on without parents' consent. So Barry Weiss has taken up their cause, but she's left of center. I mean, good for her. I tip my hat to her. But I'm just saying, this is getting so bad that you don't have to be a regenerate student of the Bible to see the craziness our culture is embracing. You can see those on the left cannibalizing themselves on universities. Who can be, you know, one's trying to outwoke the other. Chaos, discord. The thief comes to, how did Jesus put it in John chapter 10? I'm going to look it up because the wording is so apropos. The thief here it is. A stranger they will not follow. Here it is. Sheep hear his voice. Strangers they won't follow. Not the sheep. I don't know, I can't find it right now, but it's something like thief comes to destroy, basically. The thief comes to destroy. Can't find the exact words. You know what I'm talking about, though. That's what he's after. The snake. Destroy. A lot to think about there. And I hope you read carefully the solid ground that comes out in September. John 10:10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. By contrast, Jesus says, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. Boy, what a contrast. That's it. That's what we're talking about here. It's very simple. Thank you, Amy, for the reference. John 10:10, there it is. The thief and the shepherd. The thief and the shepherd. The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. The shepherd comes to give life abundantly. That's it. That's what's hanging in the balance right now. And actually, in a certain sense, has always hung in the balance since the very beginning. And we each, you and I, have a critical role to play in this. But we have to see it. We have to see it for what it is. All right, friends. I think that's enough for today. God keep you and me. May He. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.